Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Good evening. Welcome to MoFad Lab. So exciting to have you guys all here. My name is Peter Kim. I am the executive director of the Museum of Food and Drink. I see a lot of familiar faces, which is exciting. But for those of you who are new here, a bit of background on the museum. We're a nonprofit. We are a new kind of museum that brings the world of food to life with exhibits that you can eat. We inspire curiosity about food, what it means, and how it connects with the world around us. And our goal is to open the world's first large-scale independent food museum. And it blows my mind to say this, but it's true. There is no museum like this anywhere else in the world. And we think it's really important that this happens now here in New York City. To give you a sense of what we envision, we want to build a place where you can actually taste and smell your way around the world and through time, learn about the science of bread, but also discover the economics of coffee or debate the ethics of meat production or discover the fascinating neuroscience of flavor and the mysteries of the gut, taste ancient Roman food, Han Dynasty food, or space station food. And the possibilities are endless, but all very exciting. You're here now in MoFad Lab, which is sort of our test kitchen, where we are developing both our exhibits and our community as we grow. We're open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and I'd encourage you all to please come back and visit. We have an excellent exhibition up right now. It's called Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. And it tells the incredibly poignant story of how Chinese immigrants overcame white supremacy and racism to create one of the country's most beloved cuisines. So we have a very exciting program this evening. And I am very excited to have our first guest, Michael Harlan Turkell, who is an award-winning photographer. He is also an author and a radio show host, and he's worked with some of the most incredible chefs around the world. He's deeply knowledgeable about food. He actually just published a book, Acid Trip, right? About vinegar. And so it's just great to have you here, Michael. And our other guest is Nathan Myhrvold. Now, Nathan, as many of you may well know, is somebody who often defies description. I'll try to do it in 25 words or less.
I defy that.
There we go. Let's see. Polymath, former Microsoft CTO, world barbecue champion, T-Rex archaeologist, volcano explorer, malaria fighter, and one of the most influential people in food today. I think that falls under 25. And, you know, quite frankly, Nathan and his work with modernist cuisine was an inspiration for Dave Arnold, me, and my colleagues when we were first getting MoFad off the ground. We were in particular inspired by Nathan's insatiable curiosity for, you know, learning about the world of food and his unswerving commitment to doing deep dives, getting the information right, and really getting people to think about food in an entirely different way. These are values that we hold dear to ourselves here at the museum, and so it's just a tremendous honor to have Nathan here with us. Now, this evening, Michael and Nathan will be kicking off their new podcast, Modernist Breadcrumbs, on Heritage Radio Network. And Modernist Breadcrumbs is itself based in part on Nathan's forthcoming book, Modernist Bread, which is, I don't know how better to put it, but sort of a 2,642-page magnum opus homage to bread. It is the result of over 4 years of research and experimentation, and it is going to also be available for pre-sale after the program. I would be remiss if I didn't thank our partners before we proceed. So I would like to extend our gratitude to Heritage Radio Network, the 92Y, and also, of course, Modernist Cuisine for working with us on this evening's program. Before we kick things off, we're going to go and do a trailer We're going to watch a trailer for Marinus Breadcrumbs, so I guess we can go ahead and cue that right now.
There's no smell in the world of food equal to the perfume of baking bread, and few greater pleasures in eating than sitting down with a slice of freshly baked bread, good butter, and a cup of tea or coffee. This October, Modernist Cuisine founder Nathan Myhrvold and head chef Francisco Magoya will join me, Michael Harlan Turkel of The Food Scene, for Modernist Breadcrumbs, a special collaborative podcast series that takes a fresh look at one of the oldest staples of the human diet, bread. Although it may seem simple, bread is more complex than you think.
I don't remember the first time I ate bread. I think very few people do, because I must have been very little indeed. I remember the first time that I saw bread being baked. I'd asked about it, and my grandmother made a loaf of bread, and I was fascinated with the whole thing.
From the microbes that power fermentation to the economics of growing grain, there's a story behind every loaf. Each episode will reveal those stories and more, beginning with bread's surprising and often complicated past, from the perspective of people who are passionate about bread and shaping its future.
We did 1,500 experiments. That's, in the context of 3 years working on a project, 1,500 experiments, that's 500 experiments a year.
Well, I'm not sure there is such a thing as the perfect bread. There is always a very strong subjective aspect to any kind of cooking.
The five-volume, 2,642-page book, Modernist Bread, will take us into the ever-expanding world of bread. The culmination of over 4 years of nonstop research, photography, experiments, writing, and baking.
Modernist Breadcrumbs is a podcast sharing the voices, stories, and insights of top bread bakers and experts from around the world. Hundreds of hours of interviews were captured by the Modernist Breadcrumbs team, led by Michael Harlan Turkel, a passionate cook, baker, and author himself. Whether you love making bread or simply eating it, this show is sure to feed your curiosity and hunger for a truly great loaf.
You can throw a recipe together, or you can be meticulous, and chances are, both approaches are likely to produce a good bread. It is a mysterious business, this making of bread, and once you're hooked by the miracle of yeast, you'll be a bread maker for life.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in giving a warm round of applause to Michael Harlan Turkel and Nathan Myhrvold.
How's it going, everybody? So I don't really have to reintroduce.
The problem with us as a team is we've proven that we can drone on for hundreds of hours. So
250 at that. not just all Nathan, but we interviewed about 40 to 50 bakers, millers, farmers around the world. And it almost wasn't enough. We are launching this podcast, Modernist Breadcrumbs. Actually, we launched it about 2 hours ago, 3 hours ago. So go on to heritageradionetwork.org and check it out. But we recorded so many hours of interviews, and everyone had the same thing to say. They love bread. And I'm assuming that's why you're here too, right? Are there any people that are gluten-free that are in the crowd or don't like yeast? So we actually won.
Don't shame them. It's punishment enough.
Yeah. But Modernist Bread itself, this 2,642-page tome, is solely about yeast leavened breads. And before we even get to that, I have a personal question. I have a personal question for you.
Okay.
If you were a bread, what bread would you be?
Yes, well, after tonight, they'll think I'm a little stale.
Oh, get ready for the bread puns, everybody.
Yes, and I suspect by fat content I would be a brioche.
Well done, well done. So let's talk about the difference machine, the Tesla coil, curing malaria, bring better milk to the world. You do all this underneath the auspice of what you do out in Seattle, out in Bellevue, Washington. Yep. Then there's the cooking lab, this small little corner of your office, where bread is very, very analog.
It, bigger than this room, but yes.
relative to everything else you have, but why do you care about bread, something so analog?
Well, first of all, I care about food. And I've cared about food longer than I've cared about technology because I was a little baby and little babies like to eat, but not so much on technology. Also, back in my day, we didn't have none of that fancy technology. So anyway, I've always been into food. Food is both fuel for us. It's necessary to run our bodies. But food is also an enormous expression of artistic creativity in the hands of a great chef. It's an emotional experience for the person eating it. I think much of what is great about people happens in microcosms around food.
What's so great about yeast? Because we as people have it inside us, and it makes bread what it is.
Well, okay, so there's two great things about yeast, okay? One great thing about yeast is it pisses out alcohol. And
We're talking about bread or humans. Need I say more?
Well, no, but it's amazing that the same stuff also, besides pissing out alcohol, it farts out carbon dioxide, and that's what makes our bread rise. And it is really quite remarkable that the same microorganism we've harnessed in these two fundamentally different ways. In fact, we tried to find a good way of determining when bread is fully proofed. And that's not easy. And my favorite idea, which turned out not to work for a bunch of reasons, is we used a breathalyzer. Because, hey, it's exhaling alcohol, so you ought to be able to detect it. You certainly can. Unfortunately, you can't really tell when the bread is proofed. You can tell when you're making the maximum alcohol, which is not quite the same thing.
You know, what I love is that this is something that didn't work. The proof test, trying to create some kind of scientific method for it. The best way was pushing some dough and seeing how it bounces back.
Yeah, it's the puffy jacket test. When you poke your bread, you want it to come back, but not right away, right? If it's more like punching your thigh, no. Then it needs more time. Although I gotta also say, it depends a lot on each recipe for bread has sort of different characteristics. And that's one of the reasons we couldn't do a one-size-fits-all machine, is that it really is dependent on a sort of per-recipe basis.
So what else didn't work? I mean, I know
okay,
you wrote
You
this
heard
book.
Us bragging about how many experiments we did. We didn't say how many successful ones, did we?
Yeah, but that's the amazing thing about something so analog that for thousands upon thousands of years, it's been the same. So what are the innovations that you're looking for? Was there a specific spectrum, or were there a couple key things?
One of the reasons I wanted to do something on bread was that, bread is such a basic food for us that our society went on a mission to make bread really cheap. And that included doing these huge commodity scale agriculture. It also included making machine-made breads. Well, in the 1970s, both in France and in the United States, there was sort of a reaction to this, and that's how the artisanal bread movement started. And these people said, hey, this crap in the supermarket might be cheap, but it isn't any good. Let's actually make good bread. And their model was to look to the past. And it was a great idea then. The trouble is there's a limit to how much you can look at the past. So for the last 30 years, the artisanal bread movement is about doing things ever more primitively. Oh, you know, we use it by hand. We don't use mixers. Oh, we grind our own flour. Oh, we use a wood-fired oven. And my sort of rhetorical question is, okay, stone tools? Is that where we go next? Will that really make it better? Because at a certain point, being more primitive isn't a great thing. Also, part and parcel of that is that the world expects that, oh, all the best breads were in the past. Well, that's certainly not true for food in restaurants. If we went to a bunch of great restaurants in New York, we would find dishes you can only find there. They're inventions. They're brand new things that chef has done, which is terrific. If we could go to a bunch of fantastic bakeries in Brooklyn or Manhattan and Paris and London and Tokyo and Seattle, and we would find pretty much the same breads. Because, oh, you don't have a batard? Oh, you don't have a baguette? Oh, you don't have a pain de campagne? And if you stop innovation because you create this myth that can only occur in the past, you really have a problem.
But you did look to the past, and I love
the New York... Oh, of course we did. Yeah,
I love the New York Times article that came out today and talked about you walking around the Louvre with a camera strapped around you, taking pictures of bread in art.
So I kept looking for a way to find pictures, paintings of the past that were cataloged by whether they had bread in them. And you know, Google has this AI system that can determine if your YouTube video is a cat video, but they don't have one that can spot bread in pictures. And it was this is important because I wanted to see what bread looked like in the past. You know, we always all have a sense that bread was always the way we experienced it. I knew that wasn't true. The first baguette was very likely baked in 1918. Ciabatta bread was invented in the 1980s and trademarked by a baker in Milan. Okay, when it came to America, everyone thought, oh, wow, this rustic peasant bread. You know, that must be from that part of Italy I didn't quite get to in my last trip, because I don't remember seeing it, but clearly, but no, totally ersatz.
Well, how bad was old bread? I know in the first part when we were talking about history, Pompeii or trenchers or these terms of things that were flat plates and used to sop up juices. They weren't really breads. They were almost like vehicles for something else.
Well, there's a lot of wonderful, I call them vehicular foods. You know, the purpose of popcorn really is to carry the butter and salt to your mouth. it's, you know, when a chef says it accepts flavoring well, that means it usually doesn't have very much of its own. So we really got into the past. We got into the Roman bread very seriously because the Romans produced bread at enormous scale. Bread was a primary source of calories. And as a result, they had to make lots of it. So Pompeii, which is actually not a very large town, had 33 bakeries. Well, we read a bunch of things about how the Romans made their bread. And unfortunately, those things were written by archaeologists or classicists who don't know how any bread is made, much less the Roman bread. So none of their actual speculations would work. And we have a tendency to get carried away. So I discovered that Romans had a law that you had to mark your bread with a little bronze thing called a bread stamp. This thing, right here. And I thought that was so cool. Then I found an antiquities dealer that had one. So I bought it, and for the first time in 2,000 years, it went into an oven. Of course, the dealer was horrified. You know, he said it wouldn't be guaranteed. I said, look, the one thing I know is this thing likes ovens. there's a fabulous mural in Pompeii of a man distributing bread. Looks like a man selling bread to customers. And so we really got interested in that mural because if you look really closely, you can tell a lot of details of the bread. And then we got carried away enough that we built a set. We made costumes, and we did a casting call of people who worked at the lab so we could recreate the picture.
I'm just glad you didn't recreate a volcano. So. But, you know, that leads me to think, is bread art or is it science? Because it feels like a lot of the references you've had so far are from art, but where's the empirical data?
So, of course, bread is a artificial food. Artificial in the sense it was made by people. So there's lots of wonderful foods. An oyster is not an artificial food. You pry it open and you eat it, and it's the way the oysters have evolved for their own reasons. But bread is a total transformation of the grain into something else. And it was a very important invention because whole civilizations were based on grain. So if you're going to eat grain as your main thing, You got two choices, porridge or bread. What would you do? it was really a very important thing, but it's the thing I love about it is that people learned how to harness yeast and fermentation before they knew there was such a thing as microorganisms. They learned all kinds of stuff that actually wasn't known when we started our book and we figured it out, or still isn't known after we finished because we couldn't figure it out. The ability of people to learn from experience and harness something they don't fully understand is awesome. And that's why we got bread, actually, and wine and cheese. When Modernist Cuisine came out, I remember I was talking to someone who was sort of not a fan of the whole idea of modernist, and he said, well, why can't you write about really simple food? You know, like wine and cheese and bread. And of course, I laughed at them, and at first they thought I was just being rude, and then I said, look, those are not simple. Those are the most complicated things in the world. And if you don't believe me, try to make them. And of those, by the way, bread is the most forgiving. Bread is, people shouldn't be afraid of making bread, because it really is forgiving, much more so than cheese.
So I've now spent a lot of time with your head chef, Francisco Magoya. Shout out to him if he's listening.
Yeah.
And what's great is that he was not a bread baker. Yes, he dabbled in viennoiserie, but he was a pastry chef.
Yes.
And I wonder why you hired a pastry chef to write a bread book.
Well, if you saw that set of pictures, there was a picture of a brioche that was covered in carefully piped out meringue, and the whole thing had been torched. And that is part of what you get when you hire a pastry chef. So what I wanted to do is hire someone who had experience writing complicated cookbooks, and Francisco had written several prior to this, somebody who had worked in one of the top restaurants in the world. Because I am interested in a dedication to the quality of what you do and a quality of the experience that is pretty extreme. So I wanted someone who had worked for someone who had done a fantastic restaurant. Because the level of attention to detail, the focus on quality, I thought was very, very high there. And frankly, doesn't have to be as high at most bakeries. Because most bakeries are selling a $5 product. Nothing against the world of bakers and bakery, but there's only so much attention you can do to that. So Francisco had been the head pastry chef at French Laundry. And there you're spending $250 a person plus the wine. And if anything, the bread or anything isn't right, the people, you'll hear about it. And as a result, those places are run with an attention to detail that I don't think I could find any other place. Now, unfortunately, very few very top restaurants have a bread person. In fact, Thomas Keller's bread person is at Bouchon Bakery. It isn't part of French Laundry, and nothing against that. But Francisco met all of those criteria, and so, and then of course my big question is, would he be willing to come? And turns out he was.
How many bakers are in the crowd? How many bread bakers are here? Raise your hand.
Okay,
we have a handful. On Nathan's point alone, trying to teach a staff how to bake bread, you know that there's a lot of latitude. You come in one day and you see a bread one way and you see it another. How do you train somebody, or how do you teach somebody to keep within those bounds?
Well, of course, we have the luxury that we weren't a bakery, so we weren't trying to please a single fixed customer. Now, that said, we were sort of the bakery without revenue. We baked 60,000 loaves of bread for this book. We went through... I would ask Francisco, okay, how much flour are we going through? And when it got to be a pallet of flour every 3 weeks, I said, boy, that's really a lot. So everybody at our lab gained weight. And nobody at our lab has bought bread in 3 years. And it's very traumatic to them now because we've stopped baking bread, at least at that scale. There.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could have just used that volcano and put it in the ashes and preserved whatever you didn't eat at that time. But there are so many things that I want to ask you, about no need, about, do-CPR. What are the biggest innovations that have come out of bread in the past 10, 15, 20 years and continue to come out because of your book?
Well, so one of the things that is a modern innovation that dates around that time is high hydration breads. Chad Robertson's bread, for example, Chad was kind enough to write the foreword for the book. That's a modern invention. And to me, that's a modern style bread. Now, it looks really rustic and old if it's got lots of big bubbles in it. But it turns out no bread in the past did that. And we know because we have both gotten lots of bread recipes from the past. But we also found this great French scientist named Rivaud, who in the 1840s went around buying loaves of bread all over Paris, measuring them, weighing them, and determining their moisture content. And one of the funniest things about Rivaud's study is that the smallest loaf of bread he worked on was 2 kilos. And when you think about it a minute, it's very clear why. Most of the people in Paris were relying on bread for most of their calories. And if you're going to live on bread, you need about 1 pound a day. It's 0.5 kilo. So you don't bring home a nice little 200 to 300 gram baguette. That's like a snack. And you also don't take the time to make that because you're putting a lot more labor per weight of dough. So they made big old round loaves. And it's really hard dealing with a high hydration bread. We eventually invented a way to make it much easier to do a high hydration bread, like super easy. But it's super hard because when you have this high hydration means a lot of water and approaching equal weights of flour and water. That's called 100%, and that's really high. And when the dough gets like that, it's this funny substance. It's like the movie The Blob. You know, it's not a batter and it's not a dough. It kind of quivers. You touch it and it's stuck to you and it's like the Flubber movie. So it's actually really hard for Chad to train people to do that. In fact, you brought training. If you're a professional baker, you're always in training mode, because you have a large number of people who come and work for a while and then they move on to do something else. Usually something else that is easier because it's hard work.
So Francisco kept on calling bread just foam. And now you've told me that bread because of yeast is just piss and farts.
It's enriched by piss and farts, but okay, you have to piss and fart into a bunch of dough for that to work out.
Do you find poetry in bread, or do you find it completely scientific now? I know the method behind how you did your high hydration doughs, but do these things blow your mind when they actually work?
Oh, sure. Look, there's a lot of ideas that don't work. There's things that do work that are super surprising to us. One that Francisco came up with is he wondered if you could can bread. That sounds really weird, but it turns out, take a canning jar, put some dough in it, put the lid on loose just like you would if you were canning it, and bake it. As it cools down, the thing will suck down and you have canned bread. And it's actually awesome for some things. Of course, because Francisco has this pastry proclivity. The thing we've put the most use of it for at the lab is baba au rum. Because you can make this these awesome little babas down in the bottom of the thing, and then you can serve it in it. Anyway.
Yeah, and they're lining the shelves right now, and I think you had a six-month-old one, an eight-month-old, because it's hermetically sealed.
Yes, we don't, so far none have gone stale. But we only can know out about 8 months because that's when we came up with it was about 8 months ago.
But it's so cool that you're still exploring and still finding out new things.
Towards the very end of the book, I was talking to somebody now, and she is a celiac, and that's a very serious condition. We have a big chapter in the book on gluten-free breads. But my friend said, look, I would kill for a gluten-free muffin. Or not muffin, a gluten-free bagel. I said, well, good luck with that. You're never going to get a gluten-free bagel. And I sort of pompously explained why that's true. Well, I proceeded to go on a trip, a business trip, and I had this idea. And I emailed back to Francisco, and the damn thing worked. So that was the last recipe that made it in the book. Stephanie, who's over there, who's our publisher, she works for me, but she's still our publisher. She didn't want me to put the gluten-free bagel in because it would have caused a change past the deadline. Fortunately, I have a certain amount of influence with Stephanie, so we did get it in just. But not only does it make a gluten-free bagel, it's like really good.
Oh, I've tasted it, and it's genius. And even more so, the slurry method to attach all the seeds. Because nothing's worse than putting that many expensive seeds on a bagel and finding them at the bottom of your bag.
Yeah.
So you've made a gluten-free bagel and all the seeds stick.
Yes, both.
Well done.
Bagels and bao were absolutely critical to us figuring out how baguettes get to be crispy.
You're not going to tell us why.
Sure, I will. So it's been known since about the 1840s that if you inject steam into an oven right at the beginning of a bake, you can make a very crispy crust. Well, I first learned this when I was a kid, and I got Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking, and it had this very long recipe for a baguette, which I made at like 12. And the part that didn't work very well was her instructions about steam, where you had to put like cookie sheets at the bottom of the oven and then spray water on them, and that part did not work so well. And it really freaked me out, though, as a kid, because you think, well, shouldn't steam make it soggy? What is up with that? Well, fast forward to now. So when we started the book, one of the things it is like, oh, I'll look up all these things that I always wondered, and I'll see what the real answer is, because surely someone has figured this out. Nope. There were several different theories about this crispiness. They, of course, contradicted each other, and they were all, like, trivial to show false. It turns out that the bagel is one of the great counterexamples. Bagels are also steamed. Bagels are not crispy. Bagels are chewy. Another big thing for me was bao, actually, because bao, like bagels, is steamed. Now, they're only steamed. There's no other bake, so of course you wouldn't expect it to be crispy. But while playing with my food in a dim sum restaurant, I discovered you can actually peel a bao. The whole thing. Just take the whole skin off in one piece. And then I was playing with the piece. And it turns out that's another hint. Another aspect that's shared by baos and bagels and baguettes is they're shiny. The shininess occurs because a film of water covers it when you steam it, and the starch gelatinizes. And it makes it shiny. It doesn't make it crispy by itself. But once we later figured out how bread bakes, which was another mystery. If you have a rib roast this big, it takes hours to cook. If you have a loaf of bread this big, it bakes in 20 minutes. Why? How can that possibly be true? Well, it turns out the answer to that and bagels and bao answered the baguette question for us.
So the next time you're in Chinatown and see someone peeling the ice out of their bao, he might be a genius. So don't gawk. But this leads me to ovens. I mean, we're talking about steam injection, and you know that was invented by August Zeng in Austria in the 1800s. But what's wrong with ovens today? Because it's so hard to make a good loaf at home.
Well, home ovens just aren't very good at, they're sort of a compromise all the way around. A typical home oven has natural convection. That means you've got the heat at the bottom and you rely on the air currents to move things through it. They're usually not very even in their heat. They're usually not calibrated very well. And you don't get a lot of radiant heat. And these are all things that, the antithesis of this is a baker's deck oven. You get to set the temperature of the floor, the temperature of the ceiling, and you can inject steam whenever you want. And boy, that gives you a tremendous amount of control that you don't have in your home oven. So we did a whole bunch of experiments to figure out what's the best way to bake different breads in your home oven. And if it's a sandwich bread, it'll work okay. You have to, you know, we always recommend you buy a cheap oven thermometer and kind of understand what the hell temperature it is, because you can easily be off by 50 or 75 degrees, and that makes a big difference. It turns out the best way to get the crusty bread effect is not the spritzing the coffee or the cookie tins. It's to bake in cheap black cast iron. It turns out the fancy pants, Le Creuset, enameled stuff is terrible. it's the blackness of the cast iron is really important. It's not the fact just that it's cast iron. The other thing is the recipes that tell you that you have to preheat the pot. It's well-meaning, and you can get a slight improvement by preheating the pot, but you have a 450-degree pot. You're supposed to lower your boule down into it. I mean, you either burn your fingers or you dump your bread in sideways. So it turns out you can put the pot upside down, and you don't even need to preheat it, to be honest. But if you wanted to preheat it, you can just preheat the top.
So are there other hacks? Are there other things we can do to our ovens?
Well, to ovens, that's maybe the best hack that I have. For flatbreads, we love using a pizza steel, not a pizza stone. In a real pizza oven, you have a stone or ceramic floor, which gets super hot, and you put pizzas on it. So then people thought, oh, well, to replicate this in your home oven, let's put a pizza stone in there. The trouble is the pizza stone that they put in is thin. And it gets hot, but because it's stone or ceramic of some sort, it gives up its heat slowly. That's okay if it's like this thick and it's massively hot. It's not okay if you've got your little home oven doing it. So a piece of steel, the thicker the better. Quarter inch works, 3/8 is better. I really like a half inch, but a half inch gets really heavy. Just mild steel works great. There's pizza steel you can buy, but this is just a chunk of steel is the main thing. It winds up getting, not only does it have a lot of heat in it, but because metal conducts heat relatively well, it gives it up fast. And by giving it up fast, that's what lets you get a little bit of blistering on the bottom of your pizza. Now, a cast iron pan will work, and that's certainly another alternative, but
I want to know what your home kitchen is like, because I've been to the cooking lab and you have tandoors and deck ovens and wood fire, but what kind of bread do you actually bake at home?
Well, long before I made, of course, I built my kitchen long before I did any of these books, so I have two deck ovens, a proofer retarder, and two rational combi ovens.
I don't. Yeah, you're looking for me to answer?
Well, no. Okay, look, you asked. You asked. I mean, I did take the centrifuge from home to the lab when we started working on the book.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I mean, I took your centrifuge. So. But if I don't have the space in my Brooklyn apartment for, you know, a proofer and two deck ovens, what should I invest in other than, how do I proofer bread at home? How do I create, a dough cycle?
One of the things that is a big source, in general, variability is your enemy when you're trying to make bread reliably. And so anything that varies a lot, you shouldn't do. The problem with home bakers is they'll say, oh God, I screwed it up, it didn't come out. It's like, no, actually, don't blame yourself. You left it out to proof on the kitchen, and you don't have air conditioning, and it's a very different temperature at different parts of the year, so that's why it's not going to come out. It's not, don't take it personally. So people proof out on their counter. Proof in your broom closet or your bedroom closet. It usually doesn't have windows, and people aren't opening the door a lot. If you want, we should have instructions for doing a do-it-yourself proofer in the book. You take a cooler, and you go to a pet store, and you buy an aquarium heater. Because aquarium heaters are made to heat in exactly this this range. And so you put like an inch of water at the bottom of your cooler, and you put in the aquarium heater. And then if you want to be fancy, you can put in like a cake cooling rack or something to keep the pans off of the out of the water, although it doesn't really matter. And that works great. So little things like that to make sure that things are the same every time really helps. The other thing I always have to say, even though this is not primarily home cooks here, the biggest lesson that anyone should tell home cooks is do it more than once, okay? The classic thing is someone asks me, what's a good recipe for X? And I'll say, okay, when are you gonna use this? Oh, well, you know, my mother-in-law is coming over and my boss, and it's this huge thing. I said, you're going to make it before, right? Do I have to? And of course, you've screwed yourself up if you if, in fact, you say the first time I'm going to make a recipe is in that context. And again, people blame themselves. After a talk, I had this one woman come up to me and said how she was a terrible cook and she wanted to know how she could improve. And I said, well, how many times do you make the recipes? She also said it wasn't as good as she got at the local restaurant. I said, now, do you think the folks at the restaurant are making that for the first time? I was like, oh. And with bread, look, flour is really cheap, okay? And even a bad loaf of bread is not the worst thing you've ever had in your kitchen. So there's nothing to beat experience. Try it a few times. You'll get a rhythm going. If that was the only lesson I got across, I think people might feel cheated, but it would be worth the price of admission.
I've also heard home bakers blame the grain. Flour, we really haven't touched on flour. We've been talking about baking better breads, but what does access to better flour mean? What does knowing a miller or having a farmer nearby that grows a specific type of wheat mean to bread baking?
Well, I guess... One of the things we devote almost a whole volume to is the whole grain agriculture system. For 99% of the time, having a farmer nearby who grows grain doesn't help you because he's growing the same grain everybody else in the country is. And by the way, you can't do very much with it if you did get some from him. It's unfortunate, but it's true. In every food item that we care about, in order to get quality, we have to link the people who do the original agriculture, or in the case of fishing, the fishermen or whatever, the original producer of the raw food to the people who actually are preparing it to the consumer. When I was a kid, my mom bought Folgers coffee. Thank God that is not the only choice now. There's a bajillion choices, single origin, X, Y, and Z, only from the north side of the hill, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. When I was a kid, chocolate was only Hershey's. The same thing happened. And so people who care enough about it will go source those best things. Well, our society went on this giant quest to make bread almost free. That was the goal. And they did succeed in making grain almost free. So in a typical supermarket loaf of bread, the farmer gets 5 cents. And that's kind of absurd. The U.S. Department of Agriculture did this study that we looked at in this, and they broke out insurance as one of the categories. The insurance guy gets 8 cents. Okay, the plastic bag, that's 5 cents. So that's like totally fucked up, okay? You the actual product that it's all based on is nearly free. Like, hey, what if we were like totally crazy and we spent 25 cents? Whoa! Now, at the moment, if you're the baker or the farmer who's trying to make that better grain, it's really hard because you don't know who the hell to sell it to. And so there's this whole chain. Bread is at a stage that coffee and chocolate were decades ago. And it's going to be tough sledding because we have a lot of attitudes about bread that are kind of built into many of us that come from this notion that it needs to be cheap or free. When a restaurant charges for bread, people get mad. And I was talking to someone about this, and I said, well, do you think risotto ought to be free? Or pasta? And they said, well, you know, that's like a dish that the chef makes. I said, well, yeah, so? I understand that if you're used to bread being free, then you think that's part of the society's pact. But if it's something that the chef has to provide for free, they're going to put a commensurate amount of effort into it. And if we're not willing to go a little out of our way to seek out a great baker, maybe stand in line a little longer than we would at the supermarket and maybe pay a little more, if we're not willing to do that, we're getting the bread we insist on. Now, to go back to your question of the great flour, so you can get great flour at most places if you look for it. If you're a beginning baker, start off by trying to get bread flour. Bread flour is not necessarily better than all-purpose, but all-purpose flour is all over the map in terms of what it actually has in it, what protein level is in it. So unless you get used to a particular brand, you're better off with bread flour. There are small mills that do a great job. But the small mills that we got at one in Washington State that supplied a lot of flour for us, but you won't get it here. Because again, flour is so cheap that the transportation of it is just becomes an issue.
So flour is pretty much just shipping and handling.
Well, when you put it in boats, it turns out water is really slippery. So you can move flour by boat huge distances. Because pizza is a flatbread, we sort of use this as an excuse to send Francisco to VPN school to get officially certified. He also got certified as a Detroit-style pizza maker. But the funniest part of the VPN course was where the Italian guy was waxing lyrical. He says, "You know what makes the flour so great? The wheat of Manitoba." Because it's true. Okay, Italy is not a great country for growing wheat. Canada is. And great, the fancy 00 flowers from Italy all come from wheat grown in Canada.
So God forbid that we're not bread bakers in this room, but we are bread buyers. How do we invest in better bread? Do we diversify which loaves we buy? Do we frequent certain bakeries?
Well, look, New York City has some of the best bakers in the world in it. And it's got a lot of crap bread, too. Okay, I mean, certainly the supermarket is full of crap bread. But there's also, full-on bakeries, bread bakeries, that have stuff that I don't think is very good. I'm not going to sort of name and shame. That isn't my role here. I also don't like telling people what they should eat. We have a chapter on bread and health where we talk about the gluten-free phenomenon. And there are some people who have celiac disease. That's a serious thing. You need to treat it seriously, and those people shouldn't eat gluten. Now, there's a ton of other people that have self-diagnosed that they have some problem with gluten. And if they want to do that, I'm not going to tell them, no, you ought to not eat it. The trouble is, when people get some new thing like that in their lives, they tend to want to proselytize it. And the best way to proselytize it is to say it's for health. If you're proselytizing a religion, you say, you're going to go to hell if you don't do this. If you're proselytizing a food, you say, oh my God, I can't believe you do that to yourself or to your children. And, you know, the trouble is there just isn't a lot of evidence that there are people who are gluten sensitive other than people who are celiacs. And what I mean by no evidence is scientists have done these studies where they get a bunch of people who say they're very sensitive to gluten. They randomly divide them into two groups. One group gets gluten-free food. They do some other tests. The other group gets gluten-free food that they spiked pure gluten into. And they can't tell. And they've never found a group of people that could tell. Now, rarely you might find someone who has an undiagnosed case of celiac, of course. But so I don't think I should tell people what to eat, but I don't like it when people shame whole areas of food on the basis of health stuff that isn't true. Now, just to make sure everyone hates me, there's on the other side, whole grains are not better for you. The usual claim is whole wheat or whole grain breads are better for you health-wise, and they're more nutritious. And that leads to otherwise well-meaning people attacking bakers or deriding white flour. And I think that's ridiculous. Because, again, there's no evidence. It's not more nutritious. Ironically, whole grain breads are net-net less nutritious. That's because the bran has a set of chemicals called phytates in them, and those bind to other minerals and prevent your body from absorbing them. So whole grain bread basically blocks iron absorption. So if you're anemic, whole grain bread is blocking any iron you're eating at the same time you're eating your whole grain bread. There's other minerals that people say, oh, that mineral is in the bran. Well, it's in the part of the bran you don't digest. So you flush that away afterwards, and that didn't help you very much. I love whole grain breads. We have lots of whole grain bread recipes. We even came up with a way of making a whole grain bread that has almost the same volume as a white flour loaf, which takes some doing. You know, normally, there's nothing in the world that kills the volume of bread as well as bran. Now, when I say nothing in the world, we tried lead shot, ball bearings. We tried ground glass. We tried everything we could to see what is something that would cause the volume of bread to go down. And boy, bran takes the cake. And it's for two reasons. One is there is a mechanical aspect of it, that when your bread is rising, there's effectively a million little balloons in there that are getting inflated by the yeast. And the bran particles are big and they're sharp, and those actually weaken those bubbles. That's the mechanical effect, but that's actually slight. And ground glass or like chopped up fiberglass does do that. If you try this at home, make sure you label the pans. Just saying.
Well, I mean, I know some breads in the past have been adulterated with sawdust, chalk, but like this is an extreme.
Well, the other reason that bran kills the volume of bread is that bran soaks up a lot of water. So you start off with a bread, I think I'm going to make a 70% hydration bread. 70% is a pretty good hydration level to get a reasonably open crumb. And then like a third of the water gets sucked up by the bran. you now are making something that's less than 50% hydration bread, and that has a dense crumb. The biggest flour thing that we discovered, which still just freaks me out, is that there's no good rye flour in the United States. And that sounds almost absurd, but we had some bakers from Vienna come visit our lab, and they specialized in 100% rye breads, and they tried to make their bread. And these guys were so pissed off. They were cursing. They were supposed to stay for 2 days. They stayed for like a week. And they kept trying. And dumb me, I'm tasting. I said, you know, this actually tastes pretty good. And they're like cursing and cursing. And they think it must be the flour, but they couldn't put their finger on it. Well, we kept at it and kept at it and kept at it. I eventually went to Germany and I got 250 pounds of rye flour and brought it back into the United States. That's a fascinating discussion with customs. No, really, this white powder is flour. The customs guy says, I have to call my supervisor. And he gets on the interface and says, you won't believe it. This guy says he's writing a bread book. So what we discovered is that two things. First of all, rye in the United States is grown for animal feed almost exclusively. And then some of it is diverted for us to eat. Now, it's safe. It's not bad. But it's not a varieties of rye that are grown in Europe for making bread. In the U.S., if you ask your miller for a spec sheet on the flour, they'll give you a spec sheet that has all these little tests. So we called up every mill we could in the United States to ask for a spec sheet on their rye flour. None of them had any. My favorite response was this guy who said, well, it's rye. Why would we test it? But the other thing is that the rye flour they use to make 100% rye breads in Germany and Austria has the texture of cake flour. It is ultra fine. We couldn't believe that. The rye flour in the United States is usually meal. It's this chunky stuff. I talked to a whole bunch of cereal chemists. I talked to a bunch of food scientists. Nobody actually knew how rye works. We couldn't find any book in English on this, except I found a translated German technical report where these guys had figured out that the finer you grind the flour, the fluffier the bread. Dramatically. So, now, here's the part I don't understand about this. There are millions of Americans that have German ancestry at some point, including me. There's lots of Americans who live in Germany and Austria. There's lots of Germans and Austrian citizens who live here. Why? Why wasn't this figured out 50 years ago?
Well, I feel like we're going to end it there on a question mark.
Yes.
There's an amazing
Michael
story.
Has his back away slowly voice.
There's an amazing story in the book as well as on Modernist Breadcrumbs about someone in your office named Carla who gets hundreds of pounds of Austrian rye flour sent to her monthly with a little happy birthday card. Because it circumvents customs in a specific way. And luckily, if this is not enough, there is an 8-part series podcast that started today called Modernist Breadcrumbs on Heritage Radio Network. But Nathan, you never asked me what kind of bread I was.
What kind of bread are you?
I've been thinking about this whole time. I think I am ciabatta because I was born in the early 80s, but I have an old soul. There you go. But I just wanted to thank everyone here.
And when we make a sandwich out of you, some of the mayo drips out the big holes.
Oh, yeah. That will be in my memoirs. But I wanted to thank everyone here, MoFad Heritage Radio, for putting together this fantastic podcast. My Modernist Breadcrumbs team, Connor and Jordan. We also have Thomas Hughes and Gretchen Lose, who did the soundtrack for the podcast as well. And of course, Nathan Myhrvold and his whole Modernist Cuisine team for writing such a wonderful, wonderful tome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking, and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.